mean, it's just so familiar. I just don't even realize how many times we've had this discussion over the years of something like this. Tell me what's being said on that side of things.
Well, a lot of people like myself, Marzia, were not surprised at this verdict. I mean, here you have a young white guy. Many people said he characterized him as a boy. He was 17 at the time of the incident, but now he's officially a man at age 18. But yet still, they, in some of the narratives that were coming from the U.S. here, they still characterized him as a boy. Of course, diminishing his accountability in the incident where he took the lives of two people and then maimed another person. And so when you look at the optics of a man who, or a boy at the time, had a gun that is intended to kill people and goes into a protest where things are very volatile and unpredictable, one can almost expect that the outcomes may not be typically favorable with that. And then when you see someone walking away to live the rest of their life as a free man, despite having taken the lives of two people, there are a lot of people who think that a grave injustice was done here. Now, like you alluded to before, on the other side, there are those who said, well, he legally had the gun, he was allowed to be on public streets during that protest, and he was defending himself. So the jury ruled or decided in the correct direction. And that's where you see there are two schools of thought, two ideals, two understandings of the principles of America, where you can have a gun and you could exacerbate a situation. But if that situation turns on you, even though you might have been the one to instigate it, you legally have the right to defend yourself and obviously take a life without any type of reprisal. And I think that's what people are having problems dealing with as they try to process this verdict, that it was legally okay, but ethically, it was really an inhumane act that was committed by a boy who is now considered a man in American society.
I mean, what you just said, legally okay, and one would wonder if it was a black teen that had done that, if it would have been legally okay. Thanks so much for that update out of D.C., Colin Campbell. I'd like to welcome our guests to the spotlight, writer and journalist Abayomi Azikiwe out of Detroit. And writer and rights activist Yane Madako out of Philadelphia.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, we cross over to Philadelphia and start this off with Yane. Thanks so much again for being with us. Your overall opinion of the verdict?
Well, I think that, you know, it's nuanced, as was discussed by the previous correspondent, in that what we observed is that there was a lot of consideration for the humanity, overwhelm, bad mistakes, youth of, you know, Rittenhouse. And that's something that consistently happens, where there's a willingness to care about whomever the perpetrator may be when that perpetrator is white. And that same kind of consideration and generally not extended to people who are not white. And so I think that when you look at a system where you have individuals who have actually had acts of self-defense over the course of decades of people actually really truly attacking and oppressing them directly or through as members of a larger community, and those people are in prison sometimes for decades. We've got a large number of political prisoners and in the U.S. right now who are in prison for having defended themselves and protected their lives against aggressive violence in a context that we know has always been very violent. And there's very little to no consideration given to the circumstances of what happened when people are fighting for their cases. You know, when you see repeatedly that there are these efforts that these vigilantes take on the flip side and actually establish the aggression, and then, you know, when that comes back on them, protect themselves from the aggression that they created in their engagement of the act of the conflict, they're given all of this consideration. And so it just really speaks to what, speaking of political prisoners, political prisoner from Philadelphia, Mumia Abu-Jamal, said about the law here in the United States, which is that it means whatever the white men of that time want it to mean. It's not universally applied. It's not, it's created as if it's objective, but it's not universally applied.
All right, stay with me, Yanhe. Let me get Abayomi in on this discussion. Abayomi, your take in general, I mean, if he was a black teenager walking in the street with an automatic weapon, then use his weapon to kill and wound, kill two people, wound another, do you think that the court would have looked at the case in the same way? I think that's the question of the day for especially people living outside the United States who perhaps can't understand this whole situation as well. Abayomi, I can't hear you. Okay, I think you're muted. I think your mic is muted. Okay, I'm going to come back to you. Hopefully we can clear this up, the technical side of things. We can get this done. I'll go back to Yanhe. Yanhe, the same question. I mean, because especially when you're talking to an international audience, a lot of times people cannot really understand racism in the United States in the way that it is. And
right.
When they see a case like this, and they're like, well, of course, perhaps then, okay, Abayomi, I think I have your voice. Can you hear me?
All right. Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
So stay with me, Yanhe. I'm going to go back to Abayomi. Thanks so
yes,
much.
Sir.
I'm glad we got that technical issue cleared. Did you hear the question, or should I repeat it, Abayomi?
Yeah, I was saying that Tamir Rice in Cleveland several years ago was 12 years old. And he was playing with a toy gun in a public park. And a white man called 911 and said it was a child playing with a gun. It's probably harmless. Well, if it was harmless, why are you calling the police? So the dispatcher called the police and said it was a black man in the park with a gun, calling a gun. And two white police officers showed up and gunned him down within a matter of seconds. The question is almost rhetorical. This would not be the same discussion if you had a young African-American who was charged with killing two whites. And it's interesting that Rittenhouse killed two other white people and wounded a third person. One of them was Jewish. So it just goes to show even whites who are demonstrating against racism in the United States are subject to brutality, to vigilante violence, and that's just the reality that we're dealing with.
Yes, and Yanhe, I mean, we witnessed some very interesting acts during this case. I mean, such as the judge allowing him, Rittenhouse, to choose his own jury by lot. The judge said that people feel better when they are in control. It, in so many ways, it's so mind-boggling because we have seen time and time again the dehumanization process. For example, when people of color are arrested or are held on trial, put on trial, and then we see this basically the judge talking about needing control, that person. I mean, it's so mind-boggling. Your take on and so many of the situation that took place during this case.
Well, you know, there's a message that I hear. You know, we talk about the messaging that goes out through the actions and activities. You know, we talk about dog whistles, signals that you give. When you look at this case, you look at the case of Ahmaud Arbery, who was gunned down by two vigilante, individuals while taking a jog. There's a message that's going out. Even when you look at how Dylan Ruth, the young man who went to the church and shot up, a church of people who welcomed him into the church, and how they treated him after, you know, during the arrest process and route to the prison, stopping and getting them little something to eat.
Right.
There's a message that's being delivered about what you're doing and whether or not what you're doing is actually aligned with the goals of the larger establishment, and whether, therefore, it will be actually really treated punitively when they do these things. So there's a message that these people are actually aligned and deserve protection, because what they did is actually fits the goals and making sure that there's a certain communities that stay in their place as it relates to this hierarchical oppressive system. So that's what I hear in that situation. And one thing I just want to mention is that we've not only had the example of Tamir Rice, who was shot down with a toy gun within seconds of being encountered by the police. We also have examples of quite a number of fully grown, clearly grown white men who have been in public places where there were crowds of people with actual definitive guns, waving them and being talked down by the police instead of being shot down.
Right. Abayomi, what does this do to the psyche of African Americans in general, living this day in and day out? And of course, we understand different parts of the country perhaps is somewhat different. But in general, this type of systemic racism is part of the soul of the United States. What does it do to the psyche of people living with this day in and day out? I think that part of it is really not talked about enough.
I think that as W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the double consciousness, and you have to, as a black person in North America, you have to be aware all the time, particularly when you're confronting the authorities, that you could be severely harmed or killed. And, the whole book that was written in the 1960s about black rage from a psychiatric standpoint is a reality. So, yes, you do have to be extremely aware and extremely conscious about your racial identity, skin color in the United States, and also whites as well. This case illustrates clearly that if they come out in solidarity with African Americans, they could easily be killed or stigmatized for life.
It's interesting you talked about the solidarity. I want to look at the solidarity, Yane, on the other side of Rittenhouse, because the funding for his legal case, there was so much money raised for it. I mean, it sounds similar to back in St. Louis, and we saw Mike Brown being killed, and we saw the cop who did that and raised so much money for his defense. Let's talk about that divide and that side of things. That what is it then that will bring this type of solidarity for someone who obviously has killed people, but others feel that it's their responsibility to give them all the support that they can, even financial support?
Well, it's solidarity with the ideas of what is called white supremacy. I don't like that term because there's nothing supreme about these behaviors and actions, but that is what it is that people are taking a position on the side of, and they know that that's what they're doing. They're taking a position that what he did was heroic or necessary, and that he needs to be protected. And it's really his whiteness that I believe is that's drawing people to provide that kind of support and their desire to continue to perpetuate these systems that give them a feeling of having a leg up, or the opportunity to get a leg up, and what their, for most people, it would be their whiteness would provide for them. So I perceive that as being, people are, right now we're in a country that is really asking people to choose between a side, the side of humanity and the side of white supremacy. And so some people are making that choice, and they're making the choice on the side of white supremacy, consciously or unconsciously, because there are parts of the society that don't actually engage with a large number of the diverse parts of the population to actually know and understand what it's like, especially in some of these urban environments and some of these under-resourced environments that don't even understand what the environment is like. And that ignorance enables them to continue to be aligned outside of their and against their class interest with this white supremacist system that continues to oppress many of those people as well.
Right. Well, Abiyomi, how do you explain what appears to be this deep disdain for black people in certain official circles in the United States, and obviously certain individuals? Still, even in 2021, there is a type of hatred that, again, perhaps people who haven't seen it cannot understand, that an individual that you don't even know, that you could have such deep resentment towards it. Explain this to my international audience, please.
It goes back to the period of enslavement. It was necessary for the white ruling class in the United States to demonize, to make it appear as if African people were inherently inferior. They needed to be controlled. They had to be exploited, and they had to be converted to the European belief systems. So this is the origin of it. In order to maintain that system, they had to institutionalize these theories. And then even after the Civil War and the purported liberation of African people from enslavement, in order to maintain the same system of racial hierarchy and national oppression and economic exploitation, they had to continue this myth that African people were genetically inferior to whites. And even today, in academic circles in the United States, you still have these theories that are being advanced. And it becomes even more important today because you have a rising minority that is becoming a majority. It will be a majority within perhaps 20 to 25 years, a collective majority, being black, brown, Middle Eastern, Asian, and indigenous people will be a majority collectively in the United States. So they have to reinstitute another form of Jim Crow and apartheid. That's what the whole debate is around critical race theory in the schools. Critical race theory came out of the law schools in the United States many decades ago. Yet they use it as a buzzword, as a wedge issue, to justify not teaching the history of enslavement, the history of the forced removal and genocide of indigenous people, the history of the Civil War, that it was based upon whether or not the United States would be a slave system or a capitalist system, the suppression of African political rights, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, all of that. They want to suppress the teaching of this so they can rationalize or attempt to rationalize the continuation of this white supremacist system.
Well, Yone, we've seen protests after the verdict taking place in several cities. Can a system which has been built and has profited from racism actually change itself? And I guess the question would be, why would it change itself? I mean, these demonstrators, protesters are demanding a change in the justice system, but your take on that?
Yeah, I think that this system is not going to change itself, and I don't think that people are going to change the system unless they change it over with a new system that's replacing it. And a lot of people are beginning to understand the imperative to actually just build something that works for everyone and not only for a small select few. And I think part of the challenge is to help people who actually do have the same material interests to be able to operate with that understanding and not be be manipulated by the ways that those who are in conflict with those material interests are pitting groups against each other while continuing to keep pressure from above below.
So what is key? Staying with you, Yannis. So what is key
that
here?
Is going to be able to be transformed, and I think that I personally believe that it is not a good use of time to put a lot of energy into that. Certainly, I think that there are things that people need to do in order to obtain relief from the violent ways that the system itself in our communities. But what we really need is for our people thinking about what new things we can have and building something together collectively that takes care of all of the needs of the whole community.
Okay, well, Abayomi, there have been growing calls in the United States in general about secession and having the country break up and several autonomous regions. Would something like this help the racism issue in the United States? Or what do you see as key? What has to happen to change this status quo?
Yeah, the overall system has to be thrown out, and there has to be a new system instituted. And in terms of partition, you know, the issue involving the Civil War between 1861 and 1865 killed over 1 million people. And dislocated many more. So it's a serious question. And we can see the seeds of a coming civil war, another civil war in the United States in the 21st century. How can these issues be resolved short of some type of violent explosion or conflict when you have a situation where whites can at will not only kill blacks, kill whites who express solidarity with blacks. So it's a very serious situation.
And your take here, Yannis, what do you think has to happen?
I think that it is very serious. And, you know, after the verdict, I actually received messages from people who are just expressing the fact that the work that we do on the streets now seems more dangerous, right? It's actually also a form of counterinsurgency to try to create an environment where people feel afraid. So we have, you know, people who are generally wanting to just be and live at peace, and then are forced to fight and protest against the lack of peace and the violence in their lives. And if they do that, they can be there. There's legislation that passes that has been passing saying that protesters can be run down by cars. They've demonstrated that people can be gunned down, that there are no protections against even your right to assert that you have rights. And so it is very complicated. There is a lot of energy and support that's being given to those who may want to attack and who demonstrate a desire to attack the communities that bear the brunt of oppression. And so at some point in time, there is going to potentially be a standoff between these communities, because at the end of the day, people are going to stand and fight for their right to be alive and to thrive in their lives. And so when people are coming and saying, whenever you try to demand something better, we're going to shoot you down, people are going to begin to be prepared for that potential conflict and confrontation, and things can begin to get much uglier, which it seems that is being driven towards actually. And so it is a very serious question that's on the table, and there's a lot of life at stake, just
okay.
Like around the world, where there's the international community that also has to deal with the different ways that these imperialist white supremacist capitalist ideals are confronting communities all around the world.
I'm going to have to end it there. Unfortunately, I'm out of time, but I appreciate talking to both of you, writer and journalist Abayomi Azikiwe out of Detroit, and writer and rights activist Yannis Ndago out of Philadelphia. And as always, we appreciate you being with us, and hopefully you have enjoyed this spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Indeed, there was a party of my servants who said, Our Lord, we have believed, so forgive us and have mercy upon us, and you are the best of the merciful.
إنه كان فريق من عبادي يقولون ربنا آمنا فاغفر لنا وارحمنا وأنت خير الراحمين.
Verily, there was a party among my servants who used to say, Our Lord, we believe, therefore forgive us and have mercy on us, for you are the best of the mercifulness.
فَاتَّخَذْتُمُوهُمْ سِخْرِيًّا حَتَّى أَنْسَوْكُمْ ذِكْرِي وَكُنْتُمْ مِنْهُمْ تَضْحَكُونَ.
But you took them with ridicule until they made you forget my remembrance and you were laughing at them. So, brothers and sisters, faith is the beginning of forgiveness, and forgiveness is the beginning of Almighty Allah's mercy. The servants of Almighty Allah are always concerned about their shortcomings, and they always ask for divine pardon. As you have been with us previously, we were talking about the misfortune of the wrongdoers in the hereafter, and that the Almighty Allah answers their request with the firmest words, that you will be driven into it and you do not have the right to talk to me. In this verse, the Almighty Allah says, Verily, there was a party among my servants who used to say, Our Lord, we believe, therefore forgive us.
إِنَّهُ كَانَ فَرِيقٌ مِّنْ عِبَادِي يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا آمَنَّا فَغْفِرْ لَنَا.
So, in other words, you used to laugh at them, you used to scorn them and their words, and their beliefs and their behavior, but they were right. It should be noted that there is a great difference between the Arabic words sukhriyan, to take for a mockery, and sikhriyan, to put others under subjection. If the relations between the members of society were based on sympathy, cooperation, and mutual assistance, and they benefited from each other's skills and arts and labor, then the society would develop. That society would become stronger and would solve most of its problems itself. But if social relations are mainly based upon humiliation, discrimination, and hopelessness, such a society will forget Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and decline.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The verse under discussion indicates this concept by saying, "But you took them with ridicule. فَاتَّخَذْتُمُوهُمْ سِخْرِيًا حَتَّى أَنْزَوْكُمْ ذِكْرِي. And as a result, you forgot my remembrance. And you were laughing at them, وَكُنْتُمْ مِنْهُمْ تَلْحَكُونَ. But you did not know that what you were laughing at is the truth of hereafter. My people believed in me. They believed in my ghufran and in my rahmah. They believed in my forgiveness, and they used to repent, and they believed that I am خَيْرُ الرَّاحِمِينَ. I am the best of the mercifulness. But you took them with ridicule." So this is the consequence of this kind of laughing. This kind of laughing is called ridicule, and it is one of the worst sins. And it is really different from simply laughing at somebody or something. This is the kind of laugh that the headstrong people are used to. The commentators believe that every kind of sin that the Holy Quran has mentioned specific punishments and chastisements for it can be considered as the great sins, or what we call kabira. And since in this holy verse the Almighty Allah promises the very hellfire for those who ridicule the believers, this kind of laughing and this kind of ridicule is considered as one of those great sins. And this is really interesting, because they used to laugh at the people in the world, and the Almighty Allah is answering them with the same words. فَاتَّخَذْتُمُوهُمْ سِخْرِيًا in this verse says, and in the previous verse, as you remember, the Almighty Allah answered them, اِخْسَأُوا فِيهَا, be you driven into it, with the worst words. And this is the result of laughing at the believers in this world. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As the clock is ticking for a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Washington is showing more signs of unwillingness to settle disagreements despite earlier comments made by U.S. officials. On Thursday, Washington announced new sanctions on 6 Iranian nationals and one entity, accusing them of intimidating and influencing American voters during last year's presidential election. Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new sanctions as illegitimate and baseless. It said the new bans are a continuation of the failed maximum pressure policy adopted by the previous U.S. administration. Tehran also highlighted Washington's long history of meddling in other countries' internal affairs and playing a blame game to deceive the American public. Analysts say there is no evidence of any interference by Iran in the U.S.'s 2020 presidential race.
There's no evidence whatsoever that Iran or Russia had any meddling, any interference with American elections. The only meddlers in the election was really the Democrat Party and the Mossad and the Israeli intelligence operations and the CIA. They've been perfecting these programs for over 15 years, and they've undermined the elections in other countries, such as Ukraine and Venezuela, and that was admitted to by people like John McCain and John Bolton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. These elections in America have been farces and completely manipulated by the technology that the U.S. developed for influencing and corrupting other elections. But they are attempting to constantly brand Iran as a threat to the United States and trying to whip up frenzy in the American people.
U.S. President Joe Biden and his Democratic Party repeatedly criticized Donald Trump during his term for his way of dealing with Iran and withdrawing from the 2015 nuclear agreement. But ironically, since he came to power, Biden persisted in his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran and even imposed more sanctions against the Islamic Republic. This is why U.S. media and officials have admitted that the campaign against Iran has failed. Tehran held several rounds of talks with the FIPOR Plus One group between April and June with the aim of removing the sanctions, but no breakthrough was reached. Now, as the new round of talks scheduled to start on November 29th draws nearer, the U.S. measures against Iran further question Washington's sincerity about the issue, regardless of which party is at the helm in the White House.
Rights groups and families of missing persons held a press conference in Karachi to once again voice their grave concerns over the non-recovery of their loved ones, slamming the government for its lack of seriousness in their recovery. Last Saturday, families of Shia missing persons changed their direction towards military offices known to be the real powerhouses in Pakistan. Victims' families are outraged over the law enforcement agencies who they now accuse for clamping down on their right to protest. They are calling on the government to prosecute those responsible for abduction of their loved ones in the court of law. The family says state institutions are open for talks with Takfiri terrorists who have killed over 70,000 Pakistanis but are not serious to recover missing persons.
From 2009, we are protesting for the safe release of my father, and I have knocked every door of justice to the Supreme Court, High Court, and on the Commission of Enforced Disappearance, but I didn't get any positive result, or yet still I don't know where my father is.
The first post 9/11 reported case of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia, who was kidnapped from Karachi along with her three kids in 2003.
Those who at the end of the day come for the agreement, those who at the end of the day come for the negotiations that we have your men and we'll release them, let's say after 2 months, after 3 months, those are the real people. These agencies, these people who should not be named in this country, these people who are above the law, who are beyond the law, these are the real authorities, these are the real officers whose job is to run this country, but and actually they are destroying this country.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
People in Indian-controlled Kashmir have closed businesses, shops and other routine activities following a shutdown call by the pro-freedom outfit Hurriyat Conference over the recent civilian killings in a suspected encounter in Srinagar earlier this week. The streets of Srinagar appeared deserted and guarded by the government forces.
Since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi's crackdown on pro-freedom groups and its activities has kept the space with dissent here, thus adding to the frustrations among the local residents. Analysts call it an enforced silence.
The shutdown comes 4 days after the killing of civilians in a suspected encounter in Indian-controlled Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar. Denouncing the police claims, the families of victims protested against the dubious killings and the secret burial of civilians. This forced Indian authorities to return the dead bodies to their respective families for a proper burial. Political leaders, social activists, and residents took to social media in support of victim families, urging authorities to conduct a probe into the killings. 14-year-old Noha Altaf has bid farewell to her father. What she is demanding now is justice.
Our body dena hamara basic right.
Decent burial was our right. They have done no favor to us. But now is the time for them to do justice. The culprits must be hanged for killing my innocent father, so that it sets an example and such incidents should never happen again. None in Kashmir must go through what we have gone through.
According to police, 4 people were killed in Monday's encounter. The bodies of 2 civilians have been handed over, while the 3rd civilian has been buried in an inaccessible area, and the identity of the 4th person remains unknown. Shahana Butt, Indian-controlled Kashmir.
The long-standing rivalry between Russia and the United States has taken a new turn. This time, Washington is mulling whether or not to recognize the presidency of Vladimir Putin if he is re-elected. This is proposed in a cross-party resolution introduced by 2 U.S. congressmen. It calls for the U.S. to end its recognition of Vladimir Putin's presidency beyond his current term, which expires in May 2024. The bill claims that the recent amendments to the Russian Constitution, which enabled the Russian president to run for another term, are legally void. The motion has drawn fierce condemnation from the Kremlin.
Every time we think there is nothing more absurd, aggressive, unfriendly, and unconstructive that can come from that side of the ocean, and every time we are wrong, unfortunately, this is a perfect demonstration not only to Russia, but to all countries of the world that the United States officially interferes in the internal affairs of other countries.
It was only a few years ago when I believe around 100,000 advertisements made on Western social media were enough cause to launch investigations, create this whole supposedly Russiagate scandal accusing Trump of some sort of collusion or whatever. This seems to be a vastly higher level of meddling into the affairs of a foreign country. So yeah, it seems very hypocritical on its surface.
But the U.S. is no stranger to getting involved in other nations' internal affairs. Just this Tuesday, President Joe Biden banned members of the Nicaraguan government from entering the United States. He alleged that Nicaragua's November 7 vote was rigged in favor of President Daniel Ortega. In response, the Nicaraguan Congress denounced Washington for violating the principle of non-intervention in its foreign policy. Washington's failure to recognize the elected leaders of such nations as Syria and Venezuela has also drawn strongly worded condemnations for years. The U.S., however, presses on with the interference, which runs contrary to the Charter of the United Nations.
It appears that once again, outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel has had to clean up a big mess for the EU. She spoke directly with the President of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, and now the migrant crisis on the Belarus-Poland border has eased. However, the EU is pressing ahead with fresh sanctions against Belarus.
These discussions, as always, are taking place among the member states in the Council in the atmosphere of confidentiality, and we never disclose any details about ongoing discussions about who will be or who might be on that sanctions list.
The EU accuses Belarus and Russia of weaponizing migration in retaliation for sanctions. Vladimir Putin claims the West is using migrants as an excuse to heighten tensions with Moscow and Minsk. Alexander Lukashenko says genuine refugees can seek asylum in Belarus, just like in any other country. Around 2,000 migrants had gathered in appalling conditions on the Belarus side of the Belarus-Poland border. Having been aggressively pushed back from the EU by Polish authorities, they have now been relocated to a warehouse in Belarus. They are mainly from the Middle East and Asia. A sizable number of EU legislators are furious at how the leaders of their countries have treated these migrants. The 27-nation bloc's policy, they say, is to prevent asylum seekers from coming here, which is in contravention of international law. Observers say there's a great deal of hypocrisy on display.
At the moment, they're opposed to Poland, for instance, building a wall on the Belarus border. But of course, the EU itself funded billions of euro to build a wall between Syria and Turkey.
Other political commentators regularly make the point Western powers have a special responsibility to take in refugees in the light of the devastating, destabilizing impact their aggressive foreign policy has had in Africa and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Another Palestinian prisoner has died in one of the Israeli jails as a result of medical negligence. Sam Amour, 39 years old, died in custody at the Israeli Soroka Hospital in Bir el-Saba' in Al-Naqab. Amour from Deir el-Balah City in the Gaza Strip was imprisoned since 2008, and he suffered from congenital heart problems, according to the Palestinian Prisoners Society. Amour was transferred several days ago from Nafha prison to Asqalam. He was then transferred to Soroka Hospital after his health deteriorated. The Prisoners Society held Israel responsible for Amour's death because of the deliberate medical negligence and inappropriate detention conditions.
Medical treatment is among the basic rights of each man according to all international laws. Many Palestinian prisoners have died because of medical negligence. Amour was suffering from serious deteriorated health conditions. The Israeli prison authorities knew that he was in pain and had heart problems, but they never provided him with even medical examinations. It was a slow killing policy that Israel used against Amour and is now using against other prisoners as well.
227 Palestinian prisoners have died in Israeli jails and detention centers since 1967. Hundreds of other prisoners have lost their lives shortly after their release. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the main reason for the deaths of majority of those prisoners was lack of medical care.
Amour is the latest victim of Israel's deliberate medical negligence. This is one of the most prominent systematic policies that have killed many prisoners in Israeli jails. Since 1967, 227 prisoners have died behind bars. Israel continues its policies and crimes amid the international silence.
According to a statement by the Prisoners' Society, some 5,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Some 550 of the detainees suffer from very difficult health conditions due to chronic diseases and inhumane Israeli policy concerning their treatment.
The death of Sami Amour sheds light on the suffering of hundreds of sick prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian prisoners' organizations call for an immediate international intervention to save the lives of these prisoners. They also warn that Israeli jails might turn into graves for severely ill detainees, as Israel insists on keeping them behind bars without offering appropriate medical care. Mona Khandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and Children has held an event in the capital Sana'a to mark the International Day for Children's Rights. The local body released a report highlighting the tragic situation of Yemeni children amid the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade for the course of from March 2015 to November 2021.
For 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition, with the support of the United States, has been carrying out airstrikes and killing Yemeni children. This is a flagrant violation of international law that guarantees the protection of children during conflicts and wars. The Saudi-led coalition seeks to destroy the future of the Yemeni people by targeting educational facilities and depriving the children of their basic rights. These children are the basic foundation for building a new Yemen when the war ends.
The report says 300 Yemeni children die every day due to the lack of health services. The number of children suffering from cancerous tumors has also reached 71,000 as a result of the Saudi-led coalition's use of internationally prohibited weapons in bombing residential areas.
There is injustice and grave violation of rights against the Yemeni children. On top of them, it is the right to live. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has targeted schools and disrupted the educational process. The right to access healthcare also does not exist amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport and the lack of necessary medicines. When we talk about children's rights in Yemen, we feel pain, and only those who experienced it will feel this pain. The children of Yemen celebrate International Day for Children's Rights because it gives them hope despite their stolen rights.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children, and displaced millions more.
Yemenis say the atrocities of Saudi Arabia and the suffering of the Yemeni children are the results of the years-long war and siege imposed on the country. They believe that the UN's removal of Riyadh from the list of parties responsible for grave violations against children last year has emboldened the kingdom to continue its crimes in Yemen.
July 14, 2015. After years of negotiations, Iran signed a deal with the US, the UK, France, Germany, China, and Russia, which put caps on Tehran's nuclear program in return for sanctions removal. The agreement was dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. At first, it seemed like there was a new era of cooperation between Iran and the West, but that optimism was soon shattered by Washington. In 2016, Donald Trump won the race to become the President of the United States. During his tenure, he adopted an increasingly hostile attitude toward Tehran. This enmity reached a peak in 2018 when Trump unilaterally pulled his country out of the Iran nuclear deal, violating an international accord and a Security Council resolution that endorsed it. He then reinstated previous sanctions on Tehran and even imposed new ones. At the same time, he threatened other parties to the deal, including its allies, with sanctions if they refused to comply with Washington's anti-Iran measures. Despite the US withdrawal, Tehran declared that it would continue respecting its commitments under the agreement. That is, if the remaining parties, referred to as the P4 plus 1 group, guaranteed Iran's benefits as was promised under the JCPOA. Iran showed ample patience for the other sides to honor their end of the bargain. In fact, the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in its 16 reports, confirmed Tehran's full compliance with the JCPOA until 2019. It was in May that year, and a whole year after the US withdrawal, that the country started scaling back its commitments when Britain, France, and Germany failed to keep their end of the deal. Iran's remedial measures were in line with mechanisms foreseen in the text of the JCPOA, particularly Articles 36 and 37. The country, on numerous occasions, said it would reverse those measures if the other parties respected their commitments. But after more than 3 years following Washington's unilateral pullout, Iran could not see any change on the part of the Western signatories. Ironically, the new U.S. administration under President Joe Biden persisted with its predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Between April and June this year, Tehran held talks with the P4+1 group with the aim of removing the sanctions that had been illegally imposed on it. But no breakthrough was reached. Now, a new round of talks is scheduled to start on the 29th of November. Ahead of the negotiations, Iranian officials have declared that the talks must focus on the full removal of sanctions in a verifiable manner. They have also made it clear that they will not renegotiate the country's nuclear program.
As I said, these negotiations are aimed at removing the sanctions imposed by Americans through their violation of the JCPOA and Resolution 2231. We concluded nuclear negotiations in 2015, which resulted in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
Moreover, Tehran has emphasized that it will only engage in talks that lead to practical results.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
The talks between Iran and the P4+1 group will start on November 29th in Vienna, and Tehran will certainly take the other side's promises with a grain of salt, considering the West's record of violating its own commitments.
Thousands of people leaving their home countries in pursuit of a better life are now trapped in appalling conditions and fighting for survival at Belarus's western border with Poland. Their dream was to enter the EU, but now they are stuck behind barbed wires, battling freezing weather and hunger. Almost a dozen of them have already died, and fears are growing for the safety of others.
It's like so many of them doesn't have food, water, and they have small kids, and they're freezing, and the weather is pretty cold. That's all I have to say.
It's no good, no water, no food, and no time, no life.
Mostly from Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, migrants have been stranded in a wooded area for weeks. Fed up with the dire living conditions, a group of them tried to cross into Poland on Tuesday. But Polish forces, guarding the fortified border crossing, used tear gas and water cannon to push them back.
You don't follow the orders.
That triggered some to throw stones at the border guards. The incident drawing this reaction from Moscow.
The behavior of the Polish side is completely unacceptable. I think the water cannons and tear gas and shots over the migrants' heads toward Belarus state, all of it reflects a desire to hide their own actions. And they cannot but understand that they violate all thinkable norms of the international humanitarian law and other international law norms.
The EU is accusing Belarus of engineering an unprecedented wave of migrants at Poland's border in revenge for the sanctions it's suffering from the bloc. Belarus, however, denies the allegations, accusing the EU of turning its back on the migrants and trying to shift the blame on Minsk to justify its new sanctions. Russia is backing Belarus in this dispute, with the Kremlin questioning the EU's double standards over the migrant crisis, warning that such approaches put the bloc in a bad position. The EU is now looking to widen the sanctions on Belarus. Reacting to the news of the new sanctions, President Alexander Lukashenko said Belarus does not want confrontation with bloc over the migrant crisis. Lukashenko even initiated a phone call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Monday to discuss his proposal to end the crisis. Considering Belarus's earlier threat to shut down Russian gas supplies to Europe via pipelines that run through its territory, its latest reaction to the EU's fresh sanctions could be interpreted as a desire for de-escalation.